Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And we are once again joined with Paul Venable, the state chair of the Constitution Party of Missouri, and Mr. Extraordinaire. And we just finished, by the way, so congratulations. You have successfully assisted in discussing every nuance and every line of the Constitution and its ratified amendments, as well as all potential amendments that could have come forth.
Right. So we started the day after Constitution Day, and in just less than 2 months,
right,
we have, you know, covered, like you said, every line.
Right. Every line. Other than on Fridays, where I maintained,
right,
you know, Feedback Friday. So with the fact that we've kind of have done that, then as a matter of fact, it's helped me kind of go through the Constitution and redefine the color codes and all of that, which I'm going to be doing that, and I will get that up and out so that everybody can see the new updated color-coded Constitution, because there's some areas that either change colors or, you know, actually was added to the color. But prior to the day we started reading the Constitution, you and I had covered two documents that are all critical. So, reasonable people, equally informed, seldom disagree. And the problem is that everybody recognizes that we're in a really bad way. Now, tonight, you know, as this show finishes airing, I will be getting ready to cover a presentation that I am giving to a central committee. It's specifically for a central committee, the Washka County Central Committee in Wyoming. And this, I'm hoping that there will actually be some bighorn representatives and so forth from different counties that will be actually tuned into this presentation. Because tonight I'm going to use a different approach instead of trying to, you know, just argue a single point. In other words, when we really look at our problem today, there are three organizational efforts, and I don't mean single organizational efforts. I mean three directions that are being driven by multiple organizations. So when I say the Convention of States or the Article 5 Convention, that just doesn't mean the Convention of States action. I have ran across, and Paul, you know of a few other groups that are out there advocating for a very specific amendment, and they're autonomous from the COS.
Okay.
In other words, they just want to get their amendment, and they're being funded to do this. And so when all of this money is being funded to basically present to the people of America that this is their solution, all of that money, I'm telling you, is corrupt. Because the people that are driving the solution, what they think is a solution, has nothing to do with solving the problem. It will not solve the problem. And so the approach I'm going to be taking is going to be different. But before I dive into that approach and before we dive into these resolutions, we were wrapping up yesterday regarding the importance of making all elections local and basically changing the paradigm of, you know, ensuring that money that enters can only enter from the hands of the people and the pockets and the bank accounts. In other words, the origin of where that money comes from must come from within the state as much as we can possibly prove. So in other words, I'll give you a good case in point, because I started talking about this before we really ran out of time, that if you happen to have a person that has an Amazon store and they're operating out of their home in a, you know, in a county or what have you, there is a likelihood that Amazon could actually reach out to that person and say, hey, we're going to give you money to make it seem like you, you know, because you live there and you're a money retailer, we're going to shift money for you to, you know, precisely give this money and inject it into these campaigns. Because we can't do that anymore. It's illegal. Believe me, these parasites, these germs, these these evildoers will do everything they possibly can to subvert our elections and actually pervert our politicians by using money.
Right.
And so
and the politicians are looking for it.
Absolutely. Because they really believe that they're better. They really believe that they can do something. I mean, there's lots of guys and women that go into office with these ambitions of being able to do good things, all unconstitutional.
Right.
And they have no idea. This is why when we start using First Amendment petitions and when we start actually holding government accountable, we are actually changing the course and direction of this nation. Because it all has to start by holding them accountable. And then as we start holding them accountable, we can constrain the money that they're getting. We can constrain the influence of, you know, are those things that influence them, which is money. Those things that influence them are those things that benefit them. And when you look at any form of benefit, it can be deemed as compensation. So I'll give you case in point. You know, it's very clear that if you're traveling on the government dime and you're receiving, because the government is paying for it, and you receive travel awards for government air, then technically you're receiving compensation that you shouldn't receive.
How do you mean travel awards? Let's say,
in other words, like
airline points?
Yeah, airline points, correct. Okay. Hotel points, correct. That is how you can actually compensate yourself by doing something that you're already being paid to do, giving you extra benefit. If it becomes something that has a tangible value to you, then you know you shouldn't be getting it. Because government is, you're not supposed to be making, now nine times out of ten, as I know, I don't know if there's really ways other than the fact that if you really abuse it, they can come after you.
Okay.
But as I don't know of the government itself actually going around and making sure that, you know, all of their travelers aren't getting points. It's kind of this little dirty secret that, you know, the more I travel, the, you know, the benefits that I get from that. It's an extra benefit.
Well, there is a way. Yeah. There's a way to fix that. Okay. Because I worked for a company that managed the travel for all of its employees. Okay. And so they simply make the reservations. They make the, you know, they make the, they set it up so that they're paying and they don't, the employees don't get a benefit. So we probably have somebody who would be arranging the travel. And I think that could be done, Jared. That's what I'm saying. And I understand what you're saying. And in other words, in traveling on the government dime, you shouldn't be receiving any extra benefits, remunerations, compensation, or emoluments.
Right.
Is what you're saying.
Precisely. Okay. Precisely. So. Okay. So anyway. When we look at, you know, how we can drain the swamp, and because that's what, how we were leaving yesterday's show, making all elections local literally starts helping people actualize or understand, you know, get their arms around this whole concept that our public servants are there to do one thing and one thing alone, to go and represent our suffrage in government, not to violate the law, but to actually go and do the few things that you have the power to do, not to aggrandize government to do more for us. And Correct. So we've completely, I mean, just it's kind of like the Thanksgiving. I'll just bring that up again. We've completely, you know, just embraced socialism that, you know, oh, well, you know, as long as everybody agrees, we can go ahead and violate the Constitution because we agree to do it. No, you cannot violate the law. Now, which kind of really sets, I think, the stage up for the Alien and Sedition Acts. Now, we already went through these before, and we read these things in their entirety. But what I've done is I've highlighted these so that we can kind of review them. Now, the Alien and Sedition Acts were four specific acts that did very specific things which violated the Constitution. Now, you're more than welcome to go read those. I don't want to, you know, take too much time on the specific acts. But I will say this, as we go through and as we review the Kentucky resolutions right now, the first off, Paul, you have the Word document up, right?
I do.
Now, type the words nullify, or just nullif, N-U-L-L-I-F, and tell me.
Do a search?
Yeah, a search in the document. So just type, because N-U-L-L-I-F will, you know, find any nullification, nullify, you know, because it spells the words differently, but that instance is common in every kind of case of nullification or null.
Okay, let me see. Let me do a find here.
Actually, if you just do the word null, N-U-L-L, that would be better.
I did.
Okay.
And let's see what I found. Okay, I have found two instances.
Okay.
Where it's used. Okay?
Right. Okay. And that happens to be in Resolution 8. So We have not highlighted that because it's not necessarily germane to what they're doing. What we want to do, though, is we'll kind of highlight that when we get to that part so go ahead and see at the end of Prosperity of These States. Folks, forgive me for doing this administrative type of thing. We could have done this sooner, but actually what we'll do is I'm going to highlight it, and then I will read this, and I'll let you kind of cover the rest of the highlights that we have. Now,
so where are you?
Never mind, I've got it. So we're going to start up for the first section, the first resolution, where you actually have some red font words. Those words are highlighted because these are very specific to what they're really trying to do here.
Okay.
And so this is by Thomas Jefferson, who authored the Kentucky Resolutions. Go ahead.
Okay, resolved. That the several states composing the United States of America are not united on the principle of unlimited submission to their general government, but that by a compact under the style and title of a constitution for the United States, and of amendments thereto, they constituted a general government for special purposes, delegated to that government certain definite powers, reserving each state to itself the residuary mass of right to their own self-government.
So he's laying out the fact that the Constitution was ratified by the states, and in other words, that the states are the parties to it, and that the states are not parties to an unlimited government, that it was given very specific powers and only those powers, and that the residuary mass of right was left or reserved to of the rights, powers, roles, responsibilities, that was left to the states. So he's making this huge assertion after the federal government had passed the Alien and Sedition Acts. So he's drawing the line and saying, we're not united on this. Mm-hmm. Now, he actually amplifies this in the next resolution. This is just a small portion of these resolutions. Go ahead.
Okay. So, second resolved, that the Constitution of the United States, having delegated to Congress a power to punish treason, counterfeiting the securities and current coin of the United States, piracies and felonies committed on the high seas, and offenses against the law of nations, and no other crimes whatsoever, and it being true as a general principle, and one of the amendments to the Constitution having also declared that, quote, the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people, end quote.
And so what he just stated right there is that the Constitution, again, only delegated very specific laws that they had jurisdiction over. And he listed the criminal activity that the federal government could actually define and prosecute. And it happened to be treason, counterfeiting the securities and current coin of the United States, piracies and felonies committed on the high seas, and offenses against the laws of nations, and no other crimes whatsoever. So the fact that they're making speech a crime, to speak out against a public servant, that's not delegated to making, you know, the laws of the importation of certain people to say these people can't be here. That's not even delegated. So he literally, this is the beginning of how he started auditing the Constitution, in proving that the Constitution only delegated very specific things, and what they were trying to assert in these acts were not within the powers, roles, responsibilities, or property delegated, what they use the term enumerated. In other words, you wouldn't find anywhere listed in the Constitution or even mentioned the ability for them to prosecute and create laws regarding these things that these acts were covering. So in other words, he was just basically drawing the line saying, you cannot even go there, federal government.
Right.
Okay.
Correct.
All right. So now we go all the way down to 8. Okay. And it's kind of broken up. But the very first part that is highlighted, this right here turned heads. Go ahead.
Resolved that a committee of conference and correspondence be appointed, who shall have in charge to communicate the preceding resolutions to the legislatures of the several states.
Okay, so he's basically telling all the several states to stand up a committee of conference and correspondence. That right there was, you know, absolutely the most sobering thing that the states could do, because that's precisely what the states did as they were preparing to literally unite into a Continental Congress and basically declare the independence and initiate the Revolutionary War. In other words, this is the act of the states preparing and organizing themselves to mobilize force against some enemy.
Okay.
So, in other words, this was seen by many as really crossing the line. Basically, Thomas Jefferson. Now, what I'll say is the way Thomas Jefferson and James Madison talked about the Alien and Sedition Acts, they basically laid it out that these acts would destroy this nation. They would, they would cause this nation to be destroyed. Now, when we look at what they did, and we look at, I can't use any better word than hyperbole. In other words, it was a little bit hyperbolic speech of theirs to say that this actually destroys the Union. When we see today, all of the unconstitutional stuff that the federal government is doing, and we're still not destroyed.
Yet.
Absolutely yet. But we have lost control, and our government is doing things that there's no stopping them. They are literally continuing to set the stage with more and more dominoes, that when they knock the dominoes over, we will be thrown into utter destruction. Now, nobody can deny this, But the fact of the matter is when you look at what they were talking about then, you know, the controlling of a little bit of speech. I mean, we're already there. We see people today that have actually been sued thousands, tens of thousands of dollars, if not even more, for not using the right pronouns by offending somebody. Mm-hmm. When the freedom of speech is clear, it cannot be abridged. And yet our legal system has ingratiated itself that they can determine whether it's law or legal or not. And they have completely turned their backs on the Constitution and redefined the Constitution to serve their agenda. Mm-hmm. Which I actually point out in my article, Why Counties Matter Most. Almost done with it, folks. Almost done. Okay, so, or at least I'm almost ready to put out the final draft, which will be a lot cleaner than the penultimate draft. But anyway, so right here, he's basically saying, folks, it's time we got to go to war. And I think this really caused pause for the other states in one respect. They go, come on now, really? And they didn't see that it was really that dire of a situation. Compared to the things that was happening by the British to the American people, they just didn't see it. And so this caused a lot of insinuations. We'll find out, you know, when we get to the resolutions of 99, this actually caused a lot of insinuations from the other states to say, you know, you really, you know, you're crossing the line here. You know, you're making a mountain out of a molehill. And in some respects, I mean, that's what happens when you dramatize the matter at hand.
Okay.
And so, right or wrong, I mean, Jefferson was a hot and cold guy. And when he, you know, did anything, he did it with the full zest and zeal that he could do. And that's exactly what he was doing here. Now, go ahead.
Jefferson was quite the wordsmith.
Yeah, he was. Okay? Yeah, he was.
I mean, the Declaration, this has the fervor of the Declaration, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So go ahead and read the next part.
Okay. That faithful to that compact, according to the plain intent and meaning in which it was understood and acceded to by the several parties, it is sincerely anxious for its preservation, that it does also believe that to take from the states all the powers of self-government and transfer them to a general and consolidated government without regard to the special delegations and reservations solemnly agreed to in that compact is not for the peace, happiness, or prosperity of these states.
Okay, so that's a very reasonable statement. But the, you know, so he's really laying it out that this is not serving us. You are serving yourselves. And this is, you know, it questions our ability to preserve a general government that was limited and defined to these very specific things. So now he's kind of explaining in this next part, and this is, I'll read this now, because I'm picking it up from right where you left off. And that therefore this commonwealth is determined, as it doubts not its co-states are, to submit to undelegated and consequently unlimited powers in no man or body of men on earth, that in cases of an abuse, now he's kind of making this argument here, that in cases of an abuse of the delegated powers, the members of the general government being chosen by the people, a change by the people would be the constitutional remedy. Okay? Boom. Mm-hmm. So he just laid out what we're talking about.
Right.
When we use First Amendment petitions, what are we doing? And we're going into break on this. So hold your thought, and I want you to pick it right back up to where we left off. What do you do when you've got these members that are representing you in the House and in the Senate, and they're not really representing you? What do you do? And so everybody knows what we're going to talk about, and we'll be right back after this one promo. Thank you so much. The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, healthcare, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities and powers that belong to the states, is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to reclaimingtherepublic.org and go to the contribution page, and you can become a listed supporter of Liberty. Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416. Okay, so let me just pick us back up, and Paul, just in case, you know, don't forget to turn off the mute, but now, this is Jefferson basically laying out this argument, and he really points out the fact that the rightful remedy is to actually, you know, go after those people, you know, who they had chosen. In other words, it said, being chosen by the people, a change by the people would be the constitutional remedy. Am I wrong?
Correct.
Okay.
You're correct.
Okay, so now he goes into the theory of nullification. And most people think somewhere in here he's saying that an individual state must nullify. And I don't see this at all. And this is what he says, that every state has a natural right in cases not within the compact to nullify their own authority, all assumptions of power by others within their limits, that without this right, they would be under the dominion absolute and unlimited of whosoever might exercise this right of judgment for them, that nevertheless, this commonwealth, from motives of regard and respect for its co-states, has wished to communicate with them on the subject, that with them alone it is proper to communicate, they alone being parties to the compact and solely authorized to judge in the last resort the powers exercised under it. So is he calling for nullification, or is he calling for the states to unite to discuss what to do? Because he says here, and solely authorized to judge in the last resort of the powers exercised under it.
Sure. See
my point?
On the states.
So in other words, he threw this out here that we could easily nullify this, but he didn't say, you know, that the single state that he was calling, that Kentucky is going to nullify.
That's correct. He specifically did not say, we're going to nullify this.
This is correct.
He said, we need to work together. And in fact, essentially what he's saying is, the child is out of order and we need a parent conference.
Yes. And that, you know, so are you familiar with Madison's Federalist Papers regarding null and void and nullification? Probably not. Now,
I think, is it, it's in the 40s. 46, isn't it?
I'm going to look it up. I'll look it up. I'll let you. Let me see if I can actually find this as fast as you in regards to reading through this next two paragraphs. Go ahead. Or next two lines, I mean. I know I just I completely confused you, right?
Well, it's not in 46.
No, okay. No. So Go ahead and read the remainder highlighted.
Okay.
There's that little section. Down. It says Congress being not. Go ahead.
Congress being not.
It's red. It's in red. Okay, so I'll read
the next one.
Forget about the Federalist Papers. I'll let me just read this, because as I just said, that the last resort of the powers exercised under it, Congress being not a party, but merely the creature of the compact, and subject to its assumptions of power to the final judgment of those by whom and for who use itself and its powers, were all created and modified. In other words, he's basically pointing out that Congress was created by the states. They're the creatures of the compact. They are not parties to it. That's what he was saying there. You didn't have that highlighted in red?
No, I didn't.
That's not in red font. Okay, so we don't have the same document. Interesting. We'll have to make sure we have the same document for the next part.
Yeah, okay.
And then another part that I highlighted that you probably don't have is free government is founded in jealousy and not in confidence. It is jealousy and not confidence which prescribes limited constitutions. And then,
correct.
And then he also goes on in leading up to the next part that you have highlighted probably. In questions of powers, then, let no more be heard of confidence in man, but bind him down from mischief by the chains of the Constitution. That right there is a very powerful message, that the whole point of constitutions was to bind the men who were to serve us down so that they couldn't, unleash unlimited powers. Now, go ahead, because you got the rest of it highlighted, right?
I've got this commonwealth.
Yep, there you go. That's it. Go ahead.
All right. That this commonwealth does therefore call on its co-states for an expression of their sentiments on the acts concerning aliens and for the punishment of certain crimes herein before specified, plainly declaring whether these acts are or are not authorized by the federal compact. And it doubts not that their sense will be so announced as to prove their attachment unaltered to limited government, whether general or particular, and that the rights and liberties of their co-states will be exposed to no dangers by remaining embarked in a common bottom with their own, that they will concur with this commonwealth in considering the said acts as so palpably against the Constitution as to amount to an undisguised declaration that compact is not meant to be the measure of the powers of the general government, but that it will proceed in the exercise over these states of all powers whatsoever, that they will view this as seizing the rights of the states and consolidating them in the hands of the general government, with a power assumed to bind the states, not merely as the cases made federal, casus federis, but in all cases whatsoever by laws made not with their consent, but by others against their consent, that this would be to surrender the form of government we have chosen and live under one deriving its powers from its own will and not from our authority, and that the co-states recurring to their natural right in cases not made federal will concur in declaring these rights void, these acts void and of no force, and will each take measures of its own for providing that neither these acts nor any others of the general government not plainly and intentionally authorized by the Constitution shall be exercised within their respective territories.
Okay, so I think he really helps define the fact of what's really happening, that this is not done by the will of the people, the will of the parties, or anything else, that a group of people are exercising tyranny, and that this tyranny is clearly a direct violation of the compact itself. Now, in Federalist Paper 43, because that's where it is, Madison actually talks about the fundamental contract law, This is just fundamental contract law. And he basically says this: a compact, which is what the Constitution is, between independent sovereigns founded on ordinary acts of legislative authority can pretend no higher validity than a league or treaty between the parties. It is an established doctrine on the subject of treaties that all the articles are mutually conditions of each other. That a breach of any one article is a breach of the whole treaty, and that a breach committed by either of the parties absolves the others and authorizes them, if they please, to pronounce the compact violated and void. What he just said was, you know, it is up to and dependent upon each member or each party of the compact, in this case, the state, if they feel like the violation of the Constitution is so egregious that they can no longer be a party to the compact, then they can nullify the compact in its entirety. In other words, they can absolve themselves and walk away, you know, and pronounce the compact violated and void, as he stated. In other words, we're no longer held to the compact.
They could secede.
Secede, absolutely. It is the fundamental tenets of constitutions, where Lincoln came along and said, you can't. In other words, Lincoln created his own new version of contract law that has never, ever been accepted as actually tenets of contract law. In other words, what he was proposing is absolute tyranny. Absolute tyranny.
So isn't there somewhere else now? So what he's saying here is that if they're going to nullify, okay, if they're going to say, okay, you've broken the contract, therefore we're out. That's what he's saying.
Right. But if you notice through what you basically read, when he uses the word states, he's not talking about a single possessive. He is talking about plurality, the rights of the states.
Right.
Exercise over these states. So when you look at the co-states, you know, he's constantly being consistent that the states as the collective, the plurality, the parties of the compact.
Okay. This is Jefferson.
We're looking at Jefferson's resolution.
Okay.
Yeah, if you did a word search, you know, clearly it is a state's prerogative to nullify. They can nullify and step away from the compact. And that's my whole point, that even though he mentions nullification, he does not mention that is their intent.
But Madison, in 43, kind of does say that they could step away, you know, pronounce the compact violated and void, and implies that they could step away from it.
Yeah, it's a complete breach. Yes,
there was another one in which he speaks more specifically, I think, about nullification, and that the states he supports these resolutions. I thought it was in the 40s, and I don't remember which one it is.
But so I'm not sure what you're saying.
Okay.
In other words, are you implying that Madison at one point in time said it was okay for a state to nullify and stay in the Union?
No, I'm implying that somewhere I thought we'd read it before in the Federalist Papers, that Madison is saying the same thing that Jefferson is saying in the resolutions.
Yeah, I just said it. I just read that little part. It's in Federalist Paper 43, that if the compact has been violated, then it is up to each party to determine whether they're willing to stay in the compact or, you know, actually use that as their justification to walk away. Because, as he says, you know, when you look at a treaty, one single part of the treaty is mutually, this is what he says.
Okay.
Are articles are mutually conditions of each other. That a breach of any one article is a breach of the whole treaty. So if you breach one clause, mm-hmm. that clause is sufficient under contract law for you to say, that's it, we're out of here.
Right. So in other words, that's how he's defining nullification.
Right.
Okay. Okay. All right. So that's the point.
So let me... Because this is what's going to happen if we actually, if the Lord blesses us and we move forward with Republic Review, there's a good chance that California will try to nullify the Constitution by constitutional compliance. Can they?
Mm-hmm. Well, they can walk away.
On what grounds?
Because they don't want...
So based on the compact and compact law, you can only walk away when you're claiming that the compact is being violated. When the compact is being enforced, you really can't walk away.
Mm.
Does that make sense?
Mm.
So
well, it's right. It's a compact or contract, unless right. they determine.
Right. In other words, now that we're going to hold you accountable to this, California, and California says, "Well, we don't want to have any part of this." Well, hold on here. We're actually exercising those things you agreed to, and now you're saying that you don't want to agree to it anymore. The only point in time that you have to actually step away from a compact is when those agreements are being violated, not when they're actually being enforced.
Suppose California just doesn't want to do it anymore.
And
they're in violation. Then they are in violation of the compact. Can the other states hold them accountable?
Absolutely. Yes, they can. They can be subdued. In other words, the president would have authority to basically go in, because what you're talking about is that the governor, the state legislature, and the politicians of a state, even if it's the majority of the people, are now committing an insurrection against the Constitution.
They're breaking their oath of office.
There it is. So I had this discussion with Keith Broders, and he's a mutual friend of ours, folks. And Keith Broders really felt that, you know, this concept of being able to walk away at any point in time exists. Well, no, it doesn't. You know, it's not that Lincoln was right. It's the fact is that at any point in time when the compact is being violated and you can prove, hey, this is a violation, we didn't sign up for this, where's your authority to do this, then you can walk away. But when all of a sudden you go down this path that you mutually have been working with the other violators of the federal government, you know, in other words, as the federal government has been violating it and you've been working, California has been working with the federal government for years on unconstitutional things such as the environment and so forth. As a matter of fact, if I remember correctly, California's got some new laws that they're going to constrain trucking, you know, specific trucks from being able to operate on their roadways, which is a direct violation of the Commerce Clause.
Sure.
They can't do that. They can't dictate the standards of any other, you know, vehicle in this union. If you don't meet our emission standards, then you have, you know, you can't drive on our roads. They can't do that.
Right.
That's the same thing as Washington State not allowing Wyoming to actually export its coal. They can't do that. And so the federal government is protecting these states in violating the Constitution. And in other words, if all of a sudden we force the federal government into compliance and you have a couple of states that say we want to go rogue, now we have the authority to actually go in and remove every single one of these politicians. Just remove them and actually throw them in jail for an insurrection, and if necessary, basically do what Britain did and seat a government that actually gets it into compliance.
Whoa. That's interesting.
There you go. That is something that actually, you know, creates clarity, because technically the Civil War was not a violation of the Constitution. The principles of slavery was, even though it mm-hmm. was protected by the Constitution. The fact is that, you know, because those states actually seceded from the Union,
mm-hmm.
then basically said, hey, we the Union now, this new Union, and this is why I told you, the legal grounds, what Lincoln should have done as they all seceded, was he should have used the Monroe Doctrine to basically say, we no longer want any foreign or evil influence, and now we consider slavery and the slave trade that's coming in from Europe as a true threat to liberty in mm-hmm. the Western Hemisphere, and we're going after any state that is practicing slavery. And we're starting with you, Southern states, and commenced mm-hmm. a civil war that way, in basically saying, we're going to subdue you. We can't drag these states back into the Union, but we could subdue them and end slavery.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
As a foreign cause, that's something that we could have done. And we could have, and as a matter of fact, as a nation, that's what we ended up doing after the Civil War, in working with our new, you know, puppet master, Britain, in actually trying to, because Britain was trying to get the credentials of the world by, oh, look at how humane this evil empire is. And we became the lapdogs for Britain, of course, because it was all about making Britain seem more civil and, you know, when they're absolute tyrants.
Oh, so Britain got rid of slavery before we did, and supposedly traveled the world ending slavery everywhere but the United States.
Britain did not end slavery everywhere. As a matter of fact, why did South Africa, under Britain control, still maintain slavery?
Well, they still maintain control over South Africa, and that's what, you know, there was wealth in
where,
South Africa.
That's right. So okay. The only place where Britain made slavery illegal was in Britain. That's it. What they did was they paid reparations to the slave owners. They gave them, I think, a pound of silver, or a British pound, for every slave that was set free. So that
they compensated them.
Yes, so that they could turn right around and pay their slaves, or you know, to be employees. So because they knew that they were shifting their economic model.
Mm-hmm.
Right. In other words, now you can't compel people to do this, but we understand that there's a cost to, you know, for labor. You have to pay these guys. So they basically ceded the money so that you get 1 pound for every head of, you know, every slave, so that you can pay them to maintain work to be done. Because had they not done that, they would have had a Bolshevik revolution.
Right.
Because now all of a sudden you've got a whole bunch of people that have, you know, the people who lost their labor can't afford to pay them. Where am I going to get the money right to pay these guys? I was barely making ends meet.
So in other words, they actually had the foresight not to do what the Russians did.
Oh, absolutely. The Russians, they did it, and then the Russians did it. And they did. So I believe the Russians were successful in emancipating their serfs and slaves just before the end of the Civil War. And so that created a huge vacuum in Russia. And it would have created a huge vacuum here in America as well, had, you know, what we should never have done was we should never have spent the money on reparations. Or I should say, not reparations, reconstruction. Because it was the same thing. It was the same thing. Does that make sense?
What would have been the right thing to do?
The right thing to do was to, because everybody at that point in time had the right to go homestead anywhere in America. You know, it wasn't mm-hmm. like all land was under the hard control you had to buy or what have you. In America, we had homesteading. we had, you know, the right. ability for people to just move anywhere that you wanted to, just get out of mm-hmm. there. And what would have ended up happening was it would have really hurt the South even more had we not paid for Reconstruction. We paid for, you know, you want to know why we really paid for Reconstruction? Was to keep the blacks in the South.
What? In other words, instead of letting them spread around the country, to keep them in the South.
Right. Right, because there were people that were working in the North, and Thomas Sowell exposes this. There were people in the North that were lazy, that were, you know, had basic jobs, that they knew that they would lose their jobs from these hardworking freemen.
Mm-hmm.
People who were looking for work and looking to survive and looking to provide for their family, here was a great opportunity now. So they started seeing, and as a matter of fact, Sowell points this out. He points out that as soon as blacks started showing up in the northern states, you know, they started realizing that they were going to work harder, you know, to basically survive and, you know, do what needed to be done. And these people in the North didn't want... Or I should say, enough people in the North didn't want to compete. It's just like the labor unions. The labor unions do not want people competing. That benefits the company.
Right.
And so collectivism, you know, basically forces everybody and subdues everybody. And so the Reconstruction was really a way to help subdue this new... I'll just say this new group of labor that just got unleashed in America.
Okay. That's interesting. And, you know, what happened is slaves had skills. You know, they knew how to work because they did everything in the South. So I can see why they would be.
Yeah, so the one thing that they weren't doing was they weren't working in factories. So they were limited to agrarian type of tasks, skills, and so forth. And what was really growing in the Americas at the time was, you know, factories and that type of productive, you know, labor, that type of stuff. So my point is that as they moved to the North, I think that they would have been more willing to work hard. Working on an assembly line is pretty easy stuff. It's not rocket science.
Right.
And, you know, I think that they would have actually been very successful in integrating a lot faster had the Reconstruction not kept them in the South.
Yeah,
almost every time we look at what our government has done, it hasn't done it for a good reason. Or it mm-hmm. did it for a very bad reason, I should say. You know, because creating, you know, handouts is never good. Even though people looked at it and go, you know, that was a good act. No, it wasn't. There was nothing good about that.
Right.
It was a violation of the Constitution, and we would have been better off letting everybody, you know, have just making sure that nobody was going to be oppressed. Thank you for your time today, Paul. And so, folks, when we come back tomorrow, we're going to actually cover the Virginia resolutions, or actually we're going to just do a summary like we just did and kind of talk about, you know, what we didn't get a chance to go into details on that resolution before we move into Madison's report on the Virginia resolutions. Actually, no, we'll do the Kentucky resolutions of 99. I'm Jared Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic. We need your help. God bless.
Reclaiming the Republic is more than an educational radio show. My intent is to also work with you and local leadership to promote matters of the Constitution and self-governance. This way we can all promote constitutional awareness within our communities and with our elected officials and public leaders. If you love liberty and sovereignty and recognize the federal tyranny that is threatening our lives, then we are asking for your help. And here are a few ways you can help. Spread the word about this radio show, Reclaiming the Republic. It is the only radio show in the world asserting a constitutional solution to federal overreach. Download and share our podcast and content. Read, like, follow, and share our Mobiusstrip Press and Reclaiming the Republic pages on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Mobiusstrip News. Get informed about local groups in the area and get involved. Most importantly, become a constitutional warrior with your local leaders and demand that they begin applying constitutional tests to what they are doing and who they are supporting. Thank you.